Toss the kites on high, blow the birds about the sky, and all around I heard you pass like ladies' skirts across the grass.
Part 3 of Kenneth Graham's children's classic, Wind in the Willows, published in 1908. When we last left Mr. Toad, he had just been sequestered in the remotest dungeon of the best-guarded keep of the stoutest castle in all the length and breadth of Merry England. But do not despair. Toad did spend several weeks in his cell under the watchful eye of the jailer, but he soon tired of Toad's constant whining and complaints and happily turned the toad watching over to his daughter, who also worked in the prison and loved animals and had taken pity on the poor crestfallen toad. She had also learned that the toad was an animal of means and thought that if she helped arrange an escape, she would be amply rewarded. So, she devised a plan whereby Toad would be disguised as a washerwoman and make a great escape. So, now listen in as they discuss the plan. "Do be quiet a minute, Toad," said the girl. "You talk too much, and that's your chief fault, and I'm trying to think, and you hurt my head. And as I said, I have an aunt who is a washerwoman. She does the washing for all the prisoners in this castle. We try to keep any pain business of that sort in the family, you understand. She takes out the washing on Monday morning and brings it in on Friday evening. This is a Thursday. Now, this is what occurs to me. You're very rich, at least you're always telling me so, and she's very poor. A few pounds wouldn't make any difference to you, and it would mean a lot to her. Now, I think if she were properly approached, squared, I believe is the word you animals use, you could come to some arrangement by which she would let you have her dress and bonnet, and so on. And you could escape from the castle as the official washerwoman. You're very alike in many respects, particularly about the figure." "We're not," said the toad in a huff. I have a very elegant figure for what I am." "So is my aunt," replied the girl, "for what she is. But have it your own way, you horrid, proud, ungrateful animal, and I'm sorry for you and just trying to help you." "Yes, yes, that's all right. Thank you very much indeed," said the toad hurriedly. "But look here. You wouldn't surely have Mr. Toad of Toad Hall going about the country disguised as a washerwoman?" "Well, then you can stop here as a toad," replied the girl with much spirit. "I suppose you want to go off in a coach and four." Honest Toad was always ready to admit himself in the wrong. "You are a good, kind, clever girl," he said, "and I am indeed a proud and stupid toad. Introduce me to your worthy aunt, and if you will be so kind, and I have no doubt that the excellent lady and I will be able to arrange terms satisfactory to both parties." Next evening, the girl ushered her aunt into Toad's cell, bearing his week's washing pinned up in a towel. The old lady had been prepared beforehand for the interview, and the sight of certain gold sovereigns that Toad had thoughtfully placed on the table in full view practically completed the matter and left little further to discuss. In return for his cash, Toad received a cotton print gown, an apron, a shawl, and a rusty black bonnet, the only stipulation the old lady made being that she should be gagged and bound and dumped down in a corner. And by this not very convincing artifice, she explained, aided by picturesque fiction which she could supply herself, she hoped to retain her situation in spite of the suspicious appearance of things. Toad was delighted with the suggestion. It would enable him to leave the prison in some style, and with his reputation for being a desperate and dangerous fellow untarnished, and he readily helped the jailer's daughter to make her aunt appear as much as possible the victim of circumstances over which she had no control. "Now it's your turn, Toad," said the girl. "Take off that coat and waistcoat of yours. You're fat enough as it is." Shaking with laughter, she proceeded to hook and eye him into the cotton print gown, arranged the shawl with a professional fold, and tied the strings of the rusty bonnet under his chin. "You're the very image of her." Only I'm sure you never looked half so respectable in your life before now. Goodbye, Toad, and good luck. Go straight down the way you came up, and if anyone says anything to you, as they probably will, being but men, you can chaff back a bit, of course, but remember, you're a widow woman, quite alone in the world, with a character to lose. With a quaking heart, but as firm a footstep as he could command, Toad set forth cautiously on what seemed to be a most harebrained and hazardous undertaking. But he was soon agreeably surprised to find how easy everything was made for him, and a little humbled at the thought that both his popularity and the sex that seemed to inspire it were really another's. The washerwoman's squat figure and its familiar cotton print seemed a passport for every barred door and grim gateway. Even when he hesitated, uncertain as to the right turning to take, he found himself helped out of his difficulty by the warder at the next gate, anxious to be off to his tea, summoning him to come along sharp and not keep him waiting there all night. The chaff and the humorous sallies to which he was subjected, and to which, of course, he had to provide prompt and effective reply, formed, indeed, his chief danger. For Toad was an animal with a strong sense of his own dignity, and the chaff was mostly, he thought, poor and clumsy, and the humor of the sallies entirely lacking. However, he kept his temper, though with great difficulty suited his retorts to his company and his supposed character, and did his best not to overstep the limits of good taste. It seemed hours before he crossed the last courtyard, rejected the pressing invitations from the last guardroom, and dodged the outspread arms of the last warder, pleading with simulated passion for just one farewell embrace. But at last he heard the wicked gate in the great outer door click behind him, felt the fresh air of the outer world upon his anxious brow, and knew that he was free. So now, Toad was free from prison and began a short trek back to his ancestral home, the magnificent Toad Hall. And we find Toad rousing from sleep inside a hollow tree after his escape from the jail. The front door of the hollow tree faced eastward, so Toad was called at an early hour, partly by the bright sunlight streaming in on him, partly by the exceeding coldness of his toes, which made him dream that he was at home in bed in his own handsome room with the Tudor windows on a cold winter's night, and his bedclothes had got up grumbling and protesting they couldn't stand the cold any longer, and had run downstairs to the kitchen fire to warm themselves, and he had followed on bare feet along miles and miles of icy stone-paved passages, arguing and beseeching them to be reasonable. He would probably have been aroused much earlier, but he had not slept for some weeks, on straw over stone flags, and almost forgotten the friendly feeling of thick blankets pulled well up round the chin. Sitting up, he rubbed his eyes first and his complaining toes next, wondered for a moment where he was, and looking round for familiar stone wall and a little barred window, then, with a leap of the heart, remembered everything, his escape, his flight, his pursuit, remembered first and best thing of all, that he was free. For the word and the thought alone were worth 50 blankets. He was warm from end to end as he thought of the jolly world outside, waiting eagerly for him to make his triumphant entrance, ready to serve him and play up to him, anxious to help him and to keep him company, as it always had been in the days of old, before misfortune had fallen upon him. He shook himself and combed the dry leaves out of his hair with his fingers, and, his toilet complete, marched forth into the comfortable morning sun, cold but confident, hungry but hopeful, all nervous terrors of yesterday dispelled by rest and sleep and frank and heartening sunshine. He had the whole world to himself that early summer morning, the dewy woodland as he threaded it was solitary and still. The green fields that succeeded the trees were his own to do as he liked with. The road itself, when he reached it, in that loneliness that was everywhere, seemed like a stray dog to be looking anxiously for company. Toad, however, was looking for something that could talk and tell him clearly which way he ought to go. It is all very well when you have a light heart and a clear conscience and money in your pocket and nobody scouring the country for you to drag you off to prison again, to follow where the road beckons and points and not caring whither. The practical Toad cared very much indeed, and he could have kicked the road for its helpless silence when every minute was of importance to him. The reserved rustic road was presently joined by a shy little brother in the shape of a canal, which took its hand and ambled along by its side in perfect confidence, but with the same tongue-tied, uncommunicative attitude toward strangers. "Bother them," said Toad to himself. "But anyhow, one thing that's clear, they must both be coming from somewhere, and going to somewhere. You can't get over that, Toad, my boy." So he marched on patiently by the water's edge. Round a bend in the canal came plodding a solitary horse, stooping forward as if in anxious thought. From rope traces attached to his collar stretched a long line, taut, but dipping with his stride, the further part of it dripping pearly drops. Toad let the horse pass and stood waiting for what the fates were sending him. With a pleasant swirl of quiet water at his blunt bow, the barge slid up alongside of him, its gaily painted gunwale level with the towing path, its sole occupant, a big, stout woman wearing a linen sunbonnet, one brawny arm laid along the tiller. "A nice morning, madam," she remarked to Toad as she drew up level with him. "Oh, I dare say it is, madam," responded Toad politely as he walked along the towpath abreast of her. "I dare say it is a nice morning to them that's not in sore trouble like what I am. Here's me married daughter. She sends off to me post-haste to come to her at once, so off I comes, not knowing what may be happening or going to happen, but fearing the worst, as you will understand, madam, if you're a mother, too, and I've left my business to look after itself. I'm in the washing and laundering line, you must know, madam, and I've left my young children to look after themselves, and a more mischievous and troubling set of young imps doesn't exist, madam, and I've lost all me money and lost my way. And as for what may be happening to my married daughter, why, I don't like to think of it, madam."
"Oh, where might your daughter be living, madam?" asked the bargewoman.
"Oh, she lives near to the river, madam," replied Toad. "Come to a fine house called Close, to a fine house called Toad Hall, that's somewhere hereabouts in these parts. Perhaps you may have heard of it."
"Toad Hall? Why, I'm going that way myself," replied the bargewoman. "This canal joins the river some miles further on, a little above Toad Hall, and then it's an easy walk. You come along in the barge with me, and I'll give you a lift."
She steered the barge close to the bank, and Toad, with many humble and grateful acknowledgments, stepped lightly on board and sat down with great satisfaction.
"Toad's back again," thought he. "I always come out on top."
"So you're the washer in the washing business, madam," said the bargewoman politely as they glided along. "And a very good business you've got, too, I dare say, if I'm not making too free in saying so."
"Finest business in the whole country," said Toad airily. "All the gentry come to me. Wouldn't go to anyone else if they were paid. They know me so well. You see, I understand me work thoroughly and attend to it all myself, washing, ironing, clear starching, making up guests fine, gents fine shirts for evening wear. Everything's done under me own eye."
"But surely you don't do all that work yourself, madam?" asked the bargewoman respectfully.
"Oh, I have girls," said the Toad. 20 girls are thereabouts always at work. But you know what girls are, madam. Nasty little hussies, that's what I call them."
"Oh, so do I, too," said the bargewoman with great heartiness. "But I dare say you set yours to rights, the idle trollops. And are you very fond of washing?"
"Oh, I love it, said Toad. I simply dote on it. Never so happy as when I've got me both arms in the washtub, but then it comes so easy to me. No trouble at all, real pleasure, I assure you, madam.
What a bit of luck meeting you, observed the barge woman thoughtfully. A regular piece of good fortune for both of us.
What do you mean? Asked Toad nervously.
Well, look at me now, replied the barge woman. I like washing too, just the same as you do, and for that matter, whether I like it or not, I have got to do all me own naturally, moving about as I do. Now, my husband, he's such a fellow for shirking his work and leaving the barge to me that never a moment do I get for seeing to my own affairs. By rights, he ought to be here now, either steering or attending to the horse, though luckily the horse has sense enough to attend to himself, instead of which he's gone off with the dog to see if they can't pick up a rabbit for dinner somewhere, says he'll catch me up at the next lock. Well, that's as may be. I don't trust him once he gets off with that dog, who's worse than he is, but meantime, how am I to get on with my washing?
Oh, never mind about the washing, said Toad, not liking the subject. Try and fix your mind on that rabbit. A nice, fat, young rabbit, I'll be bound. Got any onions?
I can't fix my mind on anything but my washing, said the barge woman. And I wonder you can be talking of rabbits with such a joyful prospect before you. There's a heap of things of mine that you'll find in a corner of the cabin there. And if you'll just take one or two of the most necessary sort, I won't venture to describe them to a lady like you, but you'll recognize them at a glance, and put them through the washtub as we go along. Why, it'll be a pleasure to you, as you rightly say, and a real help to me, and you'll find a tub handy and soap and a kettle on the stove and a bucket to haul up the water from the canal. Then I shall know you're enjoying yourself instead of sitting here idle, looking at the scenery and yawning your head off.
Well, here, let me steer, said Toad, now thoroughly frightened, and then you can get on with your washing your own way. I might spoil your things or not do them as you like. I'm more used to gentlemen's things myself. It's my special line.
Let you steer? It takes some practice to steer a barge properly. Besides, it's dull work, and I want you to be happy. Now, you shall do the washing you are so fond of, and I'll stick to the steering that I understand. Don't try and deprive me of the pleasure of giving you a treat. Well, Toad was fairly cornered. He looked for escape this way and that, and saw that he was too far from the bank for a flying leap, and sullenly resigned himself to his fate. If it comes to that, he thought in desperation, I suppose any fool can wash. So he fetched tubs, soap, and other necessaries from the cabin, selected a few garments at random, tried to recollect what he had seen in casual glances through laundry windows, and set to. Well, a long half hour passed, and every minute of it saw Toad getting crosser and crosser. Nothing that he could do to the things seemed to please them or do them good. He tried coaxing, he tried slapping, he tried punching. They smiled back at him out of the tub, unconverted, happy in their original sin. Once or twice he looked nervously over his shoulder at the barge woman, but she appeared to be gazing out in front of her, absorbed in her steering. His back ached badly, and he noticed with dismay that his paws were beginning to get all crinkly. Now, Toad was very proud of his paws. He muttered under his breath words that should never pass the lips of either washerwoman or Toad's, and lost the soap for the 50th time. A burst of laughter made him straighten himself and look round. The barge woman was leaning back and laughing unrestrainedly. I have been watching you all the time, she gasped. I thought you must be a humbug all along from the conceited way you talked. Pretty washerwoman you are. Never washed as much as a dishcloth in your life, I'll lay. Toad's temper, which had been simmering viciously for some time, now fairly boiled over, and he lost all control of himself.
"You common, low barge woman," he shouted. "Don't you dare to talk to your betters like that, washerwoman. Indeed, I would have you know that I am a toad, a very well-known, respected, distinguished toad, and I may be under a bit of a cloud at present, but I will not be laughed at by a barge woman."
The woman moved nearer to him and peered under his bonnet keenly and closely.
"Why,
I see you are," she cried. "Well, I never. A horrid, nasty, crawly toad. And in my nice, clean barge, too. Now, that is a thing that I will not have." She relinquished the tiller for a moment. One big mottled arm shot out, caught Toad by a foreleg, while the other gripped him fast by a hind leg. Then the world turned suddenly upside down. The barge seemed to flit lightly across the sky. The wind whistled in his ears, and Toad found himself flying through the air, revolving rapidly as he went. The water, when he eventually reached it, with a loud splash, proved quite cold enough for his taste, though its chill was not sufficient to quell his proud spirit or slake the heat of his furious temper. He rose to the surface spluttering, and when he had wiped the duckweed out of his eyes, the first thing he saw was the barge woman looking back at him over the stern of the retreating barge and laughing. And he vowed, as he coughed and choked, to be even with her. He struck out for the shore, but the cotton gown greatly impeded his efforts, and when at length he touched land, he found it hard to climb up the steep bank unassisted. He had to take a minute or two's rest to recover his breath. Then, gathering his wet skirts well over his arms, he started to run after the barge as fast as his legs would carry him, wild with indignation and thirsting for revenge. The barge woman was still laughing when he drew up level with her. "Put yourself through your mangle, washerwoman," she called out, "and iron your face and crimpen, and you'll pass for quite a decent-looking toad." Toad never paused to reply. Solid revenge was what he wanted, not cheap, windy, verbal triumphs, though he had a thing or two in his mind that he would like to say. He saw what he wanted ahead of him. Running swiftly on, he overtook the horse, unfastened the tow rope, and cast off, jumped lightly on the horse's back, and urged it to a gallop by kicking it vigorously in the sides. He steered for the open country, abandoning the towpath, and swinging his steed down a rutty lane. Once he looked back and saw that the barge had run around on the other side of the canal, and the bargewoman was gesticulating wildly and shouting, "Stop! Stop! Stop! I've heard that song before," said Toad, laughing, as he continued to spur his steed onward in its wild career. The barge horse was not capable of any very sustained effort, and its gallop soon subsided into a trot, and its trot into an easy walk. But Toad was quite contented with this, knowing that he, at any rate, was moving, and the barge was not. He had quite recovered his temper, now that he had done something he thought really clever, and he was satisfied to jog along quietly in the sun, steering his horse along byways and bridle paths, and trying to forget how very long it was since he had had a square meal, till the canal had been left very far behind him. He had traveled some miles, his horse and he was feeling drowsy in the hot sunshine when the horse stopped, lowered his head, and began to nibble the grass, and Toad, waking up, just saved himself from falling off by an effort. He looked about him and found he was on a wide common, dotted with patches of gorse and bramble as far as he could see. Near him stood a dingy gypsy caravan, and beside it a man was sitting on a bucket, turned upside down, very busy smoking and staring into the wide world. A fire of sticks was burning nearby, and over the fire hung an iron pot, and out of that pot came forth bubblings and gurglings and a vague, suggestive steaminess. Also smells, warm, rich, and varied smells that twined and twisted and wreathed themselves at last into one complete, voluptuous, perfect smell. that seemed like the very soul of nature, taking form and appearing to her children, a true goddess, a mother of solace and comfort. Toad now knew well that he had not been really hungry before. What he had felt earlier in the day had been a mere trifling qualm. This was the real thing at last, and no mistake, and it would have to be dealt with speedily, too, or there would be trouble for somebody or something. He looked the gypsy over carefully, wondering vaguely whether it would be easier to fight him or cajole him. So there he sat and sniffed and sniffed and looked at the gypsy, and the gypsy sat and smoked and looked at him. Presently the gypsy took his pipe out of his mouth and remarked in a careless way,
"Want to sell that there horse of yours?"
Toad was completely taken aback. He did not know that gypsies were very fond of horse dealing and never missed an opportunity, and he had not reflected that caravans were always on the move and took a deal of drawing. It had not occurred to him to turn the horse into cash, but the gypsy's suggestion seemed to smooth the way towards the two things he wanted so badly: ready money and a solid breakfast.
"What?" he said. "Me sell this beautiful young horse of mine? Oh, no, it's out of the question. He's going to take the washing home to my customers every week. Besides, I'm too fond of him, and he simply dotes on me."
"Try and have a donkey," suggested the gypsy. "Some people do."
"You don't seem to see," continued Toad, "that this fine horse of mine is a cut above you altogether. He's a blood horse. He is partly, not the part you see, of course, another part, and he's been a prize hackney, too, in his time, and that was a time before you know him, but you can still tell it on him at a glance if you understand anything about horses. No, it's not to be thought of for a moment. All the same, how much might you be disposed to offer me for this beautiful young horse of mine?"
The gypsy looked the horse over, and then he looked Toad over, and with equal care, and looked at the horse again.
"Shillin a lake,"
he said briefly, and turned away, continuing to smoke and try to stare the wild world out of countenance.
"Shilling a leg? If you please, I must take a little time to work that out and see just what it comes to."
So he climbed down off his horse and left it to graze and sat down by the gypsy and did sums on his fingers. "Oh, 1, 2, 3. A shilling a leg. Why, that comes to exactly, let's see, 1, 2, 3. 4 shillings and no more.
Oh, no, I could not think of accepting 4 shillings for this beautiful, long, young horse of mine."
"Well, I'll tell you what I will do. I'll make it 5 shillings, and that's 3 and 6 pence more than the animal's worth, and that's me last word."
Then Toad sat and pondered long and deeply, for he was hungry and quite penniless, and still some way, he knew not how far, from home, and enemies might still be looking for him. To one in such a situation, 5 shillings may very well appear a large sum of money. On the other hand, it did not seem very much to get for a horse. But then again, the horse hadn't cost him anything. So whatever he got was all clear profit. At last he said firmly,
"Look here, gypsy, I'll tell you what we will do, and this is my last word. You shall hand me over 6 shillings and 6 pence, cash down. And further, in addition thereto, you shall give me as much breakfast as I can possibly eat, at one sitting, of course, out of that there iron pot of yours that keeps sending forth such delicious and exciting smells. In return, I will make over to you my spirited young horse with all the beautiful harness and trappings that are on him, freely thrown in. If that's not good enough for you, say so, and I'll be getting on my way. I know a man near here who's wanted this horse of mine for years."
The gypsy grumbled frightfully and declared if he did a few more deals of that sort, he'd be ruined. But in the end,
He lugged the dirty canvas bag out of the depths of his trouser pocket and counted out 6 shillings and 6 pence into Toad's paw. Then he disappeared into the caravan for an instant and returned with a large iron plate and a knife, fork, and spoon. He tilted up the pot, and a glorious stream of hot, rich stew gurgled into the plate. It was indeed the most beautiful stew in the world, being made up of partridges and pheasants and chickens and hares and rabbits and peahens and guinea fowls and one or two other things. Toad took the plate on his hip, on his lap, almost crying, and stuffed and stuffed and stuffed and kept asking for more, and the gypsy never grudged it to him. He thought that he had never eaten so good a breakfast in all his life. When Toad had taken as much stew on board as he thought he could possibly hold, he got up and said goodbye to the gypsy and took an affectionate farewell of the horse. And the gypsy, who knew the riverside well, gave him directions which way to go, and he set forth on his travels again in the best possible spirits. He was indeed a very different Toad from the animal of an hour ago. The sun was shining brightly, his wet clothes were quite dry again, he had money in his pocket once more, and he was nearing home, his friends and safety, and most and best of all, he had had a substantial meal, hot and nourishing, and felt big and strong and careless and self-confident. And that's the end of part 3. Of The Toad, pulled from Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, published in 1908. And this is your reader, Gary, saying goodbye.